Over the years, this fellowship has functioned without a minister. Services have been led by members of the congregation. Earlier this year, however, we made a change. We hired a part-time consulting minister, Reverend Karen Fraser Gitlitz, and today is Karen's first Sunday with us. Welcome, Karen. I'm just going to give you a quick little thumbnail sketch of Karen's background. Karen has a Master's of Divinity in Religion from Vancouver School of Theology. She was ordained by the the Unitarian Church in Vancouver in 2008. She's been three-quarter-time developmental minister at the Unitarian Congregation of Saskatoon since August 2012. And before that, she was at the First Unitarian Fellowship in Nanaimo. And here's a little tag end. The Gitlitz part of her name comes from her husband, Paul Gitlitz, who's a musician and a producer. So welcome, Karen. And Karen and I are sharing the leading of the service today, so we're going to be going back and forth a little bit. So I'll just turn this over to Karen for a few words of welcome.
So here I am, bringing with my suitcase, yes. Have I found the Unitarian Fellowship of Regina? Is this the right place? Have I found the Regina Unitarians? How would I know? How would I know that I've found the Regina Unitarians?
Let me help you.
Oh! Thank you, Wayne. I have a name tag. I belong here. Awesome. But what are there any other ways? How would somebody know that this is a Unitarian fellowship? Any ideas? There's a greeter there, yeah. Yep, that's really good. And there's a sign on the building, that's awesome. Anything else? What else? The symbol, yeah, and there's a banner. And what if you started talking about what some of the things that you're doing? Are there any things that you're doing that are Unitarian kind of things? How would I know I've found my people? You have a lay chaplain, yes. You have somebody out in the community doing rites of passage, helping people celebrate the moments in their lives that are important to them in ways that are meaningful for them.
The cow is always donating food from the market garden.
Lovely. Food.
For the food bank. And we all have a thing.
You're involved in things in the community, activist things. Well, I think maybe I can put my suitcase down. I might be in the right place. So I'm looking forward to getting to know you all over the next year. We started this weekend. That's true. I know Ettore. We had dinner together last night, didn't we? And Onidas and maybe a couple others back there too were there. So over this year, we're going to start to talk about some of the things we're doing together, and we're going to have some activities, and you're going to get to know me, and I'm going to get to know you. And one of the reasons I have this suitcase here is because all of us on the journey of life pick up things along the way. You've heard my bio, little bits of it, and you might have had a conversation with me and learned some things about me. But as we start to do things together, other things will come up. Assumptions that I make, I'll say something and you'll think, whoa, where did she get that from? And that's true of all of us in human relations. And I just want to invite you, when I'm carrying something in my suitcase that doesn't fit, I want you to invite you to come up to me and let me know. Because I want to learn who you really are. And the assumptions that we make just to get through our days often get in the way of that. So if you think that I'm doing something or saying something that doesn't quite fit or you don't understand or I've said something that's completely wrong, just let me know that I'm carrying something in my suitcase that isn't helpful. And if we can do that for each other, we can start to have real conversations and get somewhere. So I am excited to be here. Even with my suitcase, I look forward to all the learning that's going to come. And I welcome you to this great journey we're on together. There is more hope somewhere. I have to admit, I am not always comfortable with hope. You wouldn't necessarily know that because I do use the word a fair bit. I hope you're feeling better soon. I hope you get that job. I hope that whatever it is that you're hoping for comes true. As a way of thinking about the future, these types of hopes are pretty much indistinguishable from wishes, focused as they are on expressing a desire for a particular outcome, one particular outcome among many. And often I do have a preferred outcome. But because life is uncertain, I'm just as likely to have my hopes dashed as I am to find them fulfilled, or that's what it seems like to me. I know it's an understandable thing to want to grab on to a particular result. It could even be said to be a very Unitarian response, as it would be an inherently positive and appreciative approach to life and to the future. And after all, this is our birthright as Unitarians. The early Unitarians rejected the Calvinist view of predestination, the idea that we are all destined for heaven or hell, and this happens before we're born in a sort of Harry Potter sorting hat kind of way, and the rest of our life story is simply an unfolding or an uncovering of our fate. 19th century Unitarians disagreed with that point of view. They saw the future as an open book, one that, where the text would be written by our actions. And they fought to give everyone a chance to improve themselves. They supported evening classes for working people. They supported schooling for all children, not just wealthy children, although it must be said their understanding of all did not always include Aboriginal children. But they had within them an unrelenting optimism that was based in the belief that we were always making progress. And that belief that we were always making progress did not survive two world wars. People became aware, even the most optimistic, that we are not always improving and not all changes are positive. Another challenge that I have with hope is that when I look at the state of our country, and it seems to me that many of the things I love about Canada are in the midst of being dismantled, or when I try to comprehend the enormous number of people on the move as refugees, or when I hear about the precarious health of our planet, I can come up with a list of headlines and images drawn just from the past month's worth of news that make my insides curdle and leave me wanting to put my head down underneath my pillow and not come out. Following the news, it's easy to come to the conclusion that we're all going somewhere very quickly in something that may resemble a handbasket. Not that I know what a handbasket looks like, but it feels like one. So here's the thing. My feeling about this is that if I'm going to have anything to do with hope, it has to be real. I'm not interested in vague, wishy-washy, rose-colored promises that ignore reality or the facts as I understand them, because that feels like an insult to my intelligence, and it's not something I want to bank my life on. And this is what's at stake when we talk about hope. What is it that I am willing to bank my life on? And so I ask myself, where do I find hope, and is it even useful to look for it? When I started to pay attention to how I used this word hope, I noticed that I was more likely to use it for smaller, less serious things. A cold, the flu, a project at work, and less inclined to use it for the big issues that really shape my life. And so I wondered, why exactly am I holding back in this way? What does it mean to talk about hope with the things that really matter? So here's a true story. When Judith Leipzig began to work as a palliative care chaplain, she felt overwhelmed. Previously, her work was with children and families, where hope was always about the future, the rest of life, what it would look like. Working in palliative care with people who are dying is different. and she wondered, does it make sense to even talk about hope with someone who is dying? What does hope look like for someone who is terminally ill? As Leipzig progressed in her work, she discovered that even though she had previously thought about hope as being future-oriented, hope actually begins in the present moment. The difference between hope and hopelessness has to do with what's happening with us right now. Do we continue to feel that we belong to people? Do we feel that we have meaning and purpose in our lives? Nothing kills hope faster than the feeling of being set aside or not wanted. Leipzig found that hope flourishes where people have a sense of their dignity and their inherent worth. This comes from inside us, but it also comes from outside of us. It comes from our communities, saying, yes, you are important. And now this was the role of the historic Black church in America and in Canada. The Black Christian experience gave people a place where they could belong, where they mattered, where they could grant each other the dignity and respect as human beings that they weren't necessarily finding in other places in their lives. So coming back to Judith Leipzig, the palliative care chaplain, hope is found in the present and it's found in community. Another thing she found about hope is that when you have the sense of no options at all, when there is a complete wall in front of you, when it feels like the system is stacked against you and nothing else is possible, then it is also hard to hold on to hope. And here is another place where the African-American experience and the African-Canadian experience can inform us. The song that we sang just a moment ago, There Is More Love Somewhere, was born out of just such a time of despair when a system was stacked against them and change didn't seem like it would ever happen. African American spirituals were written to sustain a people through a horrific time. They drew heavily on the Psalms of the Hebrew Bible, many of which were themselves written in a time of exile and lament. And they sang to remind themselves that the reality they were enduring was not the only reality. A better world could exist, even if they couldn't see a way to it from their present state to the future. It was still there, and they hung on to it with song. Seen in this light, any creative act of protest, any singing out, is an act of hope. It might not lead to change in that particular moment, but if it keeps the spirit alive, if it reminds us that there is something worth acting for, worth remembering, if all we can do is remember, that is a valuable act. And naming these experiences out loud is important. Another story. Joanna Macy is a longtime environmental activist. Some of you might have heard of her or read her books. About 20, 25 years ago, she started to wonder about how to sustain activism. She was working, she herself was putting a lot of energy into what she was doing, and the people she was with were pouring their life energy into what they were doing. And they were tired. They were exhausted. And so she wondered, how do we nurture ourselves when these changes that are required are such long-term things? And she said, if you see the true nature of the problems facing us, if you feel that your actions are so small and bear so little fruit, how do you keep your energy going for the long haul? As a practicing Buddhist, she began reading more deeply in Buddhist psychology. And she started to investigate her own grief and her own anger. She learned about the Buddhist perspective on what we do with anger and what we do with grief and how they can freeze up inside of us and become despair, sapping us of energy and the will to act. Anyone who has grieved a serious loss knows that it takes a lot of energy. When my mom died, I slept a lot afterwards. My body just needed sleep. It takes energy to grieve. It takes energy to be angry. And when we exist in conditions that stir up grief and anger on a regular basis, and we don't work with those emotions that are coming up, or when there is trauma associated with those emotions, they become frozen inside of us. And the energy of that grief and anger is locked, and we don't have access to it anymore. Macy looked at the activists around her, and she realized that that was what was happening with her cohort, with her people. They were so open to the pain and suffering around them, and so hurt and angry and frustrated and grieving, that it just got locked inside them, frozen. So Joanna took her own experiences as her laboratory, and she started working with the grief, trying to get back through that place of feeling locked into that original moment of pain, feeling the suffering of some other being or some other person. She took herself to that place and let herself be touched by it once again. And when she found that place, and when she stayed with it, she found she was able to reconnect with that energy. Running from the despair was not the answer. She needed to face her own despair and move into it. But she didn't have the tools. So she started to work with people and draw from many sources to create rituals that would invite people into a safe experience of their own despair. She crafted something she calls the Council of All Beings, in which people form a circle and invite into the circle the spirit of all the animals in their region, all the beings in their region. And as people are moved, they take on the voices of those beings without voices and speak from that place of that animal or that being and the suffering that it is seeing as a way of getting in touch with the pain that originally drew them into activism. She took people back in history through meditations where they experienced themselves as part of the great chain of being, connecting back to the original pulse of life. She said we must live in this place of despair, but when we do it together, when we name it, when we stand in this circle and free this energy up, then things begin to move again. And people see new ways forward, new ideas come out. Because another thing that Joanna Macy observed about change is that it doesn't come in a smooth progression. Writing their book, Active Hope, Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone talk about how to face the mess we're in without going crazy, which I think has to be the best subtitle for a book that I've ever seen. We need to sustain ourselves because things look for a period of time like nothing is happening, and then all of a sudden the change will happen and you don't know when it's going to happen. So we need to be ready for it. She uses an example of a bottle of water put in a freezer. The water cools down gradually, but the appearance of the water does not change. It stays liquid until it reaches a certain temperature when crystals begin to form. And then more crystals form around the crystals, and within a very short time, all of a sudden, you have ice. A complete change of state. And social change is like this, too. We move along. It feels like nothing is happening. Nothing. And then something will change. And we need to be there, ready for that moment. In 1860, when Olympia Brown wrote to American seminaries asking to be accepted as a ministry student, most of them said no, or even didn't bother to reply. The Unitarian School of Meadville, Pennsylvania, replied to her request for admission saying, "The trustees thought it would be too great an experiment to admit a woman." Oberlin replied that she could be admitted, but they would not let her to do anything in public, which is sort of required of a minister. Ebenezer Fisher, president of the Universalist Divinity School at St. Lawrence University, offered her admission but then added that he, quote, did not think women were called to the ministry, but I leave that between you and the great head of the church. As Olympia said later in life, this is exactly where it should be left, and she arrived, much to the surprise and horror of the other professors and the students. But she had been offered admission, and she took him up on it, even though he really didn't mean to offer her admission. She was ready for that letter. She needed only the slightest crack in the door to walk right through it. Where one person might have read a discouraging letter, she saw the opportunity for what it was. She was ready, and she showed up and walked in. Hope is not a wish. It might feel like a feeling, but it's really a way of acting. It's a choice. Hope is the action of gathering together to support one another, creating ponds of sanity where we give voice to our longings and our values. Hope is the act of singing out the pain, crying out in lament, naming what is happening in the circle of community. Hope is the choice to search out the stories of creative response, to make sure that what's coming into our minds is not just what is wrong, but also seeing what is right and lifting it up. Hope is an act of creative imagination. It sends a beacon out to all those others who feel alone and isolated in their opinions, and it says, yes, we are here, and change is possible. Hope is often best understood by those who have found a way to endure great suffering. I've spoken of the African Americans' experience of slavery. Here in Canada, we have Indigenous peoples who have experienced years, decades, centuries of oppression at the hands of state and society. And I wonder, what strategies have they learned? Can I grant them the dignity and worth of being people from whom I might learn something about hope and resilience? Hope is living for the long vision of who we might yet become. May this community be a place that nurtures and acts for hope. Amen. Blessed be.
Well, thank you, Karen. That was really wonderful. I think that when we think about hope and despair, many of us are the activist types, and we do feel despair. And hearing your message of coming together in community, not to run away from that despair, but to work through it together and in song, that's really a balm for the soul. B-A-L-M. Is that right?
Yeah.
Watch out what I say. Karen, sometimes after the presentations, we have a little discussion and so forth. Would you like to take questions or have that discussion time? Okay, so you've got one. Mike and I have the other here. Are there people who want to ask questions or make comments?
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Going back to the hope aspect of what you mentioned, and with regard to either Buddhist philosophy or the Christian philosophy or whatever philosophy, where do we give hope in saying, do you know what, you could be reincarnated, you're going to go to heaven? Instead of, to my knowledge or my sensitivity, where hope also is what you do as a live person. Where do you think, is there a connection between the two, or this is something we should be working on, not just for the whatever future it will be for the present, which I think was the meaning of your presentation?
Do you want to...
Am I to respond?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Different people find hope in different places. And I would never put somebody down, I think, for finding hope in their way. I'm trying to find hope in my way. And I encourage each person to find what works for them.
I like to make a distinction between hate and anger. And to tell the truth, I think we need to find joy in anger. If at the time of the Occupy movement, the slogan came up, 91%, the 1%, and people would say, well, so what? What are they asking for? What do they want? Instead, they should have joined in the anger to say something needs to be done and feel good about being angry.
Okay, are there other comments here? Okay.
In Dante's Inferno, the inscription above the gates of hell says, all ye who enter, abandon all hope. And I think it is essential to keep hope alive regardless all of the circumstances, because that's when you enter hell. Hmm. That's when there is no potential positive outcome. And it's not about being realistic and whatnot. It's like you said, even a broken heart can contain the whole universe. So no matter what happens, always keep that hope alive. And regardless of where you get it from, you should keep it alive.
Yeah.
So I agree with that.
Thank you so much, Karen. I really needed that today, and I have to say I have been feeling that enormous despair and, yeah, the state of the world for the most part, and I do a lot of work in the community, and, you know, I'm active, but I'm tired. And so it was perfect timing. One of the songs that we sing in another group I'm related to that sometimes comes to sing here, it's called The Sacred Web. And one of the songs that Carolyn McDade wrote is Serenity. And the first line in the chorus is, serenity isn't freedom from the storm, but peace within the storm. Mm. And that also I find a great chant. So when I'm feeling really up against the wall, that helps a lot too. But thank you so much.